You are now listening to Jess is Lit on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Jess is Lit. We are back with another episode of some Shakespeare. We have gotten some rain the past couple of days. I kind of missed it, not going to lie, although I really do enjoy the sun. But it seems like the weather is clearing up a bit, which is good. Enjoy the sunshine, all you guys, at least the folks here in the Lower Mainland. But yeah, today we will continue on with the sonnets as usual. We have already finished off 35, and so we'll be finishing or starting off from sonnet 36 today. I'm hoping to get through until sonnet 40, and so we'll see how time goes. And I do have a couple of songs for you guys, and today I will bring back Blair Lee. She is an artist based in Canada, I believe, and so her songs are pretty mellow, and it brings off a really cool vibe, and so I decided to choose her for today. And so two songs will be played from her, and that's basically it. I hope you guys are doing well. My morning started off a little hectic. I woke up a little late, but other than that, everything seems to be going fine. Finals are still underway. My final is on the 24th, and so I am studying for that, and I hope everyone does well with their final kind of week of finals week. Before Sonnet 36, I will play some ads, show promos, and PSAs, and play our first song of the day called Last Bite from Blair Lee. And so we will be right back after those. Here we go.
Just a few words before I go to sleep. I feel like I'm going to dream tonight. Big bad ones, you know? The kind you like.
There is a lot of music out there, but only some is strange enough for you. My name is B, and on SlimeWire, I do the work for you, picking out freaky tunes to rule your nighttime world. So check it out, every Wednesday at 10 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
DOXA, Western Canada's largest documentary film festival, returns to present the 24th edition from May 1st to the 11th. DOXA will screen a roster of timely and thought-provoking documentaries in theatrical venues across the city, bringing filmmakers and audiences together for an engaging cinema experience. The 2025 lineup showcases 39 features, 30 short and mid-length films, and industry events. Screenings will take place at the Vancouver Playhouse, the Cinematheque, VIF Center, and SFU Goldcore Center for the Arts. Head to doxa.ca to grab your tickets and explore all that DOXA has to offer this May.
Storytelling is powerful. Our stories carry personal and collective histories, build bridges of understanding, and shine light on unseen truths. Your story, your voice, your power. CITR and Discorder is excited to announce the release of 5 unique podcasts as a part of its Power and Voice podcast incubation program. Power and Voice is an entry-level educational program created by CITR to surpass traditional barriers to entry into the medium of spoken word radio and podcasting. The result is a series of podcasts demonstrating a wide diversity of work in genre, structure, and content. Tune in every day from April 14th to 18th from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. to hear Power and Voice storytellers share their stories on their own terms and in their own words. We'll be right back.
As a station, we believe in playing content with artistic and cultural merit, and sometimes that category includes material which can be construed as offensive. For those who have children nearby or are sensitive to provocative material, the following broadcast may have strong language, themes, or be otherwise objectionable. Please consider tuning out and revisiting CITR after this program.
There are some people that aren't into all the words. There are some people that would have you not use certain words.
Opinions expressed are solely those of the presenter and may not reflect the views of CITR Radio or the University of British Columbia.
Bad words.
Shit, piss, fuck, cock, sucker, mother, and tits. Wow.
This program may contain language that some listeners find offensive. Listener discretion is advised.
Tits doesn't even belong on the list, you know?
Jake, you're back. Shut your face. I came back.
Welcome back to Jess's Lit. Those were some ads, show promos, and PSAs, and Last Bite by Blair Lee. We will now start Sonnet 36. Let me confess that we two must be twain. Although our undivided loves are one, so shall those blots that do with me remain. Without thy help, by me might be born alone. In our two loves, there is one but respect. Though in our lives a separable spite, which though it alter not love's sole effect, yet doth it steal sweet hours from love's delight. I may not evermore acknowledge thee, lest my bewailed guilt should do thee shame. nor thou with public kindness honor me, unless thou take that honor from thy name. But do not so I love thee in such sort, as thou being mine, mine is thy good report. So that was Sonnet 36. So here the poet accepts the fact that for the sake of the beloved's honorable name, their lives must be separate and their love will be acknowledged, unacknowledged. And so lines 1 to 2, let me confess that we two must be in twain, although our undivided loves are one. So we are opened with a confession. The speaker acknowledges a necessary separation in we two must be twain, even though their love remains unified and whole in our undivided loves are one. And so it's a paradox of being separated despite a shared undivided love. And this immediately introduces the theme of conflicted identity and forced distance with a tender tone. Moving on to lines 3 and 4, so shall those blots that do with me remain, without thy help by me be born alone. So here the speaker bears some kind of guilt or shame in the word blots, and which he does not want his beloved to share. And so this ultimately suggests a protective impulse where by accepting separation, the speaker can shield the other person from the stain of his transgressions or dishonor. And we could see here a sense of responsibility and moral self-sacrifice. And so the metaphor of blots could represent sins or social disgrace or some kind of moral flaw. Moving on to lines 5 and 6. In our two loves, there is but one respect, though in our lives, a separable spite. Now here again, love remains unified in spirit, as we could see in the phrase one respect, even though their external circumstances or fates portrayed in our lives are divided by a separable spite. And it's a phrase, the separable spite's a phrase that captures a kind of bitter external force that, in a sense, causes division. The phrase also implies that some external interferences or social obstacles. So we could see a juxtaposition of the one respect and of the separable spite, and how that we could see it reinforces the inner unity versus the outer division. Line 7 and 8, which thought it alter not love's sole effect, yet thought it steal sweet hours from love's delight. So even though their love remains unchanged at its core, in lovers' love's sole effect, the circumstances prevent them from enjoying it fully. How it, quote-unquote, steals sweet hours. And so we could also see how this line introduces a sense of quiet mourning and explains how love is untouched in essence but thwarted in practice. Moving on to lines 9 to 10, I may not evermore acknowledge thee, lest my bewailed guilt should do thee shame. Now, here, the speaker cannot publicly acknowledge the beloved, again out of concern that his own guilt or misdeeds might bring disgrace. This could point to social pressures, perhaps difference in status, scandal or taboo love, and there's also pain in this concealment, and yet the speaker still chooses it out of love. Lines 11 to 12. Nor thou with public kindness honor me, unless thou take that honor from thy name. Likewise, the beloved is warned against publicly honoring or associating with the speaker, for fear that doing so would tarnish their reputation. And here we see that the theme of reputation versus genuine emotion is prevalent, and the speaker sees love as something private and untainted by public judgment, however, nonetheless, vulnerable to it. And so there's a sense of conflict between the inner truth and social appearance. Moving on to the final couplet, but do not so I love thee in such sort as thou being mine, mine is thy good report. And so the poem ends with an affectionate assertion. The speaker doesn't want the beloved to risk disgrace in do not so, and expresses a kind of spiritual union in the phrase thou being mine, being that your good name is already mine and I cherish it as much. And there's also a possessive but reverent tone where love is so complete that the beloved's honor is internalized by the speaker. So in a sense, the final couplet, to generalize, affirms love's bond as it concedes to necessary separation. So that was Sonnet 36. Moving on to Sonnet 37. As a discrepant father takes delight to see his active child do deeds of youth, so I, made lame by fortune's dearest spite, take all my comfort of thy worth and truth. For whether beauty, birth, or wealth, or wit, of any of these all or more, entitled in thy parts do crowned sit, I make my love engrafted to this store, so then I am not lame, poor, nor despised, whilst that this shadow doth such substance give, that I in thy abundance am sufficed, and by a part of all thy glory live. Look what is best, that best I wish in thee, this wish I have than 10 times happy me. This poem feels a bit crippled by misfortune, but takes delight in the blessings that is heaped by nature and fortune on the beloved. Lines 1 and 2, as a discrepant father takes delight to see his active child do deeds of youth, we are presented with a simile, and the simile opens with a striking image. An old, perhaps weakened father that is watching his youthful child take action and reliving vitality through the child. And the word decrepit is poignant, which invokes physical weakness, decay, and perhaps uselessness. However, the father takes delight, and his joy is now living vicariously through the next generation. And we can see that Shakespeare sets up a model of love that is both self-effacing, and deeply connected. Moving on to lines 3 and 4. So I, made lame by fortune's dearest spite, take all my comfort of thy worth and truth. So here the speaker compares himself to the decrepit father, claiming to be made lame, quote-unquote, emotionally, socially, or perhaps spiritually, by, quote-unquote, fortune's dearest spite. And so we have an oxymoron here, and this oxymoronic phrase heightens the bitterness of his condition, where the dearest, suggesting intensity or an intimacy, and spite, which suggests cruelty here, and he's been wronged by fate, but finds solace entirely in the beloved's worth and truth. And so the sonnet's emotional anchor, I would say, would be these virtues of moral and perhaps social aspects to it. Lines 5 to 8, for whether beauty, birth, or wealth, or wit, or any of these all or more, entitled in thy parts do crowned sit, I make my love engrafted to this store. Now this catalog, beauty, birth, wealth, wit, they list conventional attributes of social and personal value. And so the syntax here folds back on itself, where in the quote, or any of these all or more, emphasizing the beloved surpassing abundance. And the phrase crowned sit gives the beloved a regal image, where their virtues enthroned in their very being. And the speaker says that his love is engrafted to this store, which is in a sense a horticultural metaphor, and to engraft is to attach one plant to another, so it grows as part of it. And so here we could see that his love is not separate, but fused into the beloved's riches, and his self-worth is tied to theirs. And so again, we see a fusion of identities, of emotional and social substance. Lines 9 to 12, so then I am not lame, poor, nor despised, whilst that this shadow doth such substance give, that I in thy abundance am sufficed, and by a part of all thy glory live. Now here is a turning point, and by being attached to the beloved's virtues, the speaker is not lame, poor, or despised, despite initially saying he was. The phrase substance is paradoxical and key in a sense, where the shadow, often lesser or illusory, of the beloved's presence somehow gives real sustaining substance. And so we see a reversal of expectations. The image of the beloved is enough to sustain the speaker's identity. The phrase I am sufficed and by a part of all thy glory live, these two parts kind of speak to a relationship where the speaker's survival and joy are dependent on a fraction of the beloved's fullness. And so we can see how it's a bit humble and almost devotional in love, a kind of emotional economy where even a fragment of anything gives life. The final couplet we have come to, look what is best, that best I wish in thee, this wish I have, then 10 times happy me. Now, the final couplet is a wish and a turned inward. So it kind of turns inward with a wish. And so the speaker projects an ideal phrase, what is best, onto the beloved, and then immediately reflecting that the act of loving and wishing for the best in them makes him ultimately happy. And so there's a reciprocal emotional reward here, where even if unfulfilled, the act of loving and the desire for the beloved's good will elevate him. And so the sonnet, in a sense, mediates on love as a source of strength and identity, in particular in the face of personal suffering or perceived failure. And so we can see that the speaker, diminished by fortune, finds emotional resurrection in the beloved's virtues. Moving on to sonnet 38. How can my muse want subject to invent, while thou dost breathe that pourest into my verse, thine own sweet argument too excellent for every vulgar paper to rehearse? Oh, give thyself the thanks if aught in me worthy perusal stand against thy sight. For who's so dumb that cannot write to thee when thou thyself dost give invention light? Be thou the 10th muse 10 times more in worth than those old 9 which rhymers invocate. And he that calls on thee, let him bring forth eternal numbers to outlive long date. If my slight muse do please these curious days, the pain be mine, but thine shall be the praise. Now here we see that the poet attributes all that is praiseworthy in his poetry to the beloved, who is his theme and inspiration. So lines 1 and 4, how can my muse want subject to invent, while thou dost breathe that pourest into my verse, thine own sweet argument too excellent for every vulgar paper to rehearse. Now, these opening lines begin with a rhetorical question. The speaker wonders how his muse could lack a subject to invent, to write about, while the beloved is still alive, in while thou dost breathe. So the idea here is that the mere existence of the beloved supplies an endless wellspring of inspiration. And the phrase, thou dost breathe that pourest into my verse, makes the beloved not just a passive object of description, but also an active force who pours content into the poet's writing. And also the phrase, thine own sweet argument, refers to both the beloved's beauty and character and the quote-unquote argument or theme of the poem. Now, we see how this is too excellent for every vulgar paper, meaning ordinary, unworthy writing, surfaces, or common writers. And so the poet acknowledges the inadequacy of language and even of himself to fully capture the beloved's worth. Lines 5 to 8, oh, give thyself the thanks if aught in me worthy perusal stand against thy sight, for who so dumb that cannot write to thee when thou thyself dost give intention light. Here the speaker insists that if anything in his poetry is worthy of being read, in worth perusal, the credit belongs not to him but to the beloved. The phrase, give thy the thanks, the logic is that the beloved is so inspiring that even the mute or inarticulate, in the phrase, who's so dumb, could write in their presence because the beloved, in a sense, gives invention light, which illuminates or enables the creative process. This line reverses the usual flow of inspiration, where the poet is not enlightening the subject, but the subject enlightens the poet. Moving on to lines 9 to 12, be thou the 10th muse, 10 times more in worth than those old 9 which rhymers invocate, and he that calls on thee, let him bring forth external numbers to outlive long date. Now this passage elevates the beloved above the classical tradition, and so the 9 muses were the goddesses of the arts in Greek mythology, which were often invoked by poets. But the speaker here says that the beloved should be the 10th muse, and not just added to the group, but 10 times more valuable than all of them combined. So the poet suggests that anyone who invokes this new superior muse should be able to produce eternal numbers, immortal verses, that will ultimately outlive long date, meaning that they will last far beyond the current age. This again also subtly reflects on Shakespeare's own ambition, and it was to write poetry that will endear through time. A kind of reproduction, in a sense, or like how we read in the sonnets 1 to 17th, to procreate and to preserve life and works and beauty. The final couplet, if my slight muse do please these curious days, the pain be mine, but thine shall be the praise. So here the poet closes with a modest tone. If his slight muse, his humble poetic ability manages to please the curious days, then he will bear the labor and effort, but the praise will belong to the beloved. And so this sonnet can be seen as a mediation on creative inspiration, in which here Shakespeare gives full credit for his poetic achievements to the beloved. So that was Sonnet 38. Before we move on to Sonnet 39, I have a song to play for you guys. And it is called Last Bite by Blair Lee. So we will come back. Last Bite was the one we played before. This one is called All Day. So we will be right back after this. That was All Day by Blair Lee. We will get right into Sonnet 39. Oh, how thy worth with manners may I sing, when thou art all the better part of me. What can mine own praise to mine own self bring, and what isn't but mine own when I praise thee? Even for this let us divided live, and our dear love lose name of single one, that by this separation I may give that due to thee which thou deservest alone. O absence, what a torment would thou prove, were it not thy sour leisure gave sweet leave to entertain the time with thoughts of love, which time and thoughts so sweetly doth deceive, and that thou teachest how to make one twain by praising him here who doth hence remain. Now here, as we have seen in Sonnet 36, the poet finds reasons to excuse the fact that he and the beloved are parted. First, it's easier to praise the beloved if they are not a single one. and second absence from the beloved gives the poet leisure to contemplate their love. So in lines 1 to 4, the sonnet opens with a rhetorical dilemma. How can the speaker praise the beloved without appearing immodest or vain, since the beloved is the better part of himself? Now, it's a metaphorical, metaphysical conceit where it's conflating the lover and the beloved as one being, and how that's very central to this question. Praising the beloved then is like praising himself, and that undermines the humility and authenticity that love and praise are meant to have. Moving on to lines 5 and 8. Now here the speaker resolves the dilemma with a surprising proposition, and it is to embrace separation. And if they are not one, he can legitimately give the beloved their due praise. And so love typically seeks unity, but here separation is, in a sense, paradoxically valued because it enables true admiration, artistic tribute, and individual recognition. So the phrase "lose name of single one" reflects the idea that lovers are often seen as merged identity, but here the poet deliberately undoes that merging and sacrifices unity for expressive justice. Moving to lines 9 to 12. So here the speaker shifts again to an apostrophe to absence and personifies it as both the tormentor and teacher. And so the absence is sour leisure, bitter idleness, but it also offers a sweet leave or permission to dream and reflect. So there's an interplay between the tormentor and teacher. And as we acquire the imaginative thought, love continues and even will thrive. The phrase "so sweetly doth deceive" is significant here, as it suggests that memory and fantasy fill the void and transforms absence into a kind of productive illusion. Moving on to the final couplet here, where the final couplet crystallizes the main paradox, where absence teaches how to divide the unified one into twain, which is basically meaning separate people, so that the speaker can praise the beloved from afar. Now, by praising the beloved, or praising him here who doth hence remain, the poet uses the notion of separation as a poetic tool. And so we can see how the notion of absence enables art to flourish and to come alive. And so the self can now speak of the other as distinct, and through that, making love both the subject and the enabler of poetry. So that was Sonnet 39. We will give Sonnet 40 a read. "Take all my loves, my love, yeah, take them all. What hast thou then more than thou hadst before? No love, my love, that thou mayest true love call. All mine was thine before thou hast this more. Then if for my love thou my love receivest, I cannot blame thee for my love thou usest. But yet be blamed if thou thyself deceivest, be willful taste of what thyself refusest. I do forgive thy robbery, gentle thief, although thou steal thee all my poverty, and yet love knows it is a greater grief to bear love's wrong than hate's own known injury. Lavicious grace in whom all ill will shows, kill me with spites, yet we must not be foes. Now, lines 1-4, we are given with a paradox of giving and having. So the phrase, take all my loves, here the plural loves can refer to various affections or romantic entanglements, but he quickly narrows to one in the phrase, my love, which is seen as a term of endearment and ownership. And the paradox here is that if everything was already yours, what does it mean to take more? And so there's no real gain for the lover. They already possessed his love fully. And the phrase, no love that thou mayest true love call, is an act of taking more. And that taking more is not love in the truest sense. It's desire, perhaps lust, but not genuine love. And so these lines here emphasize the totality of the speaker's emotional gift and also the futility or wrongness of the beloved's overreaching desire. Moving on to lines 5-8. Now here we see a kind of legalistic argument here where if you're with another person because they love you and you're not the object of the love, then that love somehow flows from you, how can I blame you? Or from me, then how can I blame you? So it's a bit of a complicated but direct question there. And then the speaker pivots. If you deceive yourself choosing something you once rejected, then that itself is a willfully self-decepting thing. So the language of receivest, usest, deceivest, refusest suggests a sense of rhetorical or legal trial and a weighing of motives and outcomes. So lines 9-12, forgiveness and emotional cost. Gentle thief here is tender. A bit of an oxymoron here where a thief is also yet gentle. And so it kind of captures the contradiction of loving someone who has hurt you. And the speaker here conveys or compares the betrayal to a robbery, but not of riches, but of emotional poverty. And so even with so little, the beloved has taken it all. And the final couplet of this quatrain hits hard, at least to me, because the betrayal in love hurts more than hatred. And so because love carries expectation and intimacy and trust, its violation is more profound. And there's a deep vulnerability here as well, where even when stripped of everything, the speaker still leans at least slightly towards forgiveness. So moving on to the final couplet, we hit a bitter climax. To quote, lavicious grace in whom all ill will shows, kill me with spites, yet we must not be foes. Now, the word lascivious grace is another oxymoron, and it compares sensual charm, or not compares, but it explains sensual charm wrapped in elegance. And so the beloved's allure makes even wrongs look attractive. And the phrase, all ill will shows, in a sense, captures how corruption or betrayal can be made to seem beautiful or forgivable. But despite this, and despite being figuratively killed by the lover's spites, the speaker insists that they must not be enemies, which is interesting. And so we could see how this final couplet is a final act of self-negation or submission, and it reveals the devastating pull of love even in the wake of pain. And so that was Sonnet 40 for you guys. We will finish off the sonnets here for today. I do have one more. I did say I have two songs for you guys, but I added one last minute song just because I love Blair Lee so much. And so before we end off the show, I will play one more song called Don't Wanna Leave by Blair Lee, and we'll be right back.
I can fully understand this is not a good decision.
That was Don't Wanna Leave by Blair Lee, and we have already come to the end of the show today. We went over Sonnet 36 to 40, and so next episode we will be going over Sonnet 41 and onwards. My next episode will be, I believe, on the Wednesday, which is my normal time, April 23rd. At 11 a.m. And so I will see you guys on Wednesday, 11 a.m. for those of you guys who are tuning in. And of course, again, if you guys have any other recommendations that you guys want me to go over and read or play, please let me know and I'd be happy to do so. But other than that, have yourselves a wonderful rest of the day and I will see you guys again in a couple of days. Thank you all. Bye-bye.
said I can't trust you anymore. A false-hearted lover.